It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm joined once again by my good friend and colleague, Attorney John Birdsall. How you doing, John?
I'm great, Kirk. How are you?
Great. How are things down in your neck of the woods?
Summerfest is going
on. How's Summerfest treating you?
Summerfest is a blast, actually. I live in the Third Ward, so it's...
That's why it's a blast for you, because you don't have to deal with any of the traffic problems.
I know. I get to watch the traffic.
Like the rest of us, mere mortals that live up here.
Mere mortals. So, plus I have a resident... placard that I put in my windshield, which allows me to get in when other people can't. So I'm not saying I'm really important, but I'm really important. You know what I'm saying?
That's awfully convenient. Is that legal or?
Yeah, well, yeah, the police issue them so that.
Oh, so that because certain, you live there and right. They don't want you to suffer the consequences.
Well, they don't want other people. Basically. Yeah, they don't want other people saying, oh, I live there. You know, no, you don't live here. You know, but anyways, Summerfest is a blast. It's been gorgeous weather. Mostly.
Yeah, you know. Have you seen rained a little bit Friday, I know, but Have you seen anybody interesting?
As far as bands go, I saw the Commodores.
Yeah.
I saw the Commodores. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I saw Styx. I saw what else did I see? There was a couple other like classic bands, and there was a bunch of like local I shouldn't say they're local, but they were not big names.
Lesser knowns.
They were not big names, but they were excellent. You know, they played like a wide so, you know, as usual, Summerfest delivers. If you haven't gone, you should go. It's fun.
I'm being a little facetious here because you and I went to see Paul McCartney on Friday night. So,
oh yeah,
I know that's right. I went with you.
I forgot about him. Yeah, what was that band he was in? Long time ago.
Something like the Roaches or the.
Yeah, it was a bug of some sort. I don't know. Anyways, we'll figure it out later.
All right. Well, aside from being right in the midst of Summerfest festivities, there's been a lot of shooting black people going on, I've noticed.
Yeah. I hope that's not a coincidence, but...
No, I don't think it is. But there was, of course, just happened coincidentally where two videos made the rounds all over the country. I saw them both practically minutes apart because there was a
same here.
NPR... news piece on it that included links to both videos, and there was the one case that I think the first one was the one in Baton Rouge where a fellow was
selling CDs
outside
that little
store because
they
said he was acting up or something like that, and there was a report that he might have a gun, and then you can see quite clearly there's actually two different cameras
the one in the,
did you see them both?
I saw them both, and they're both equally disturbing.
Yeah.
You know? Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, they wrestle him to the ground in a typical tactical move to get control of the situation. Nothing. Well, it's disturbing to watch that when it happens just because, you know, it's disturbing in and of itself. But then, that's how police are trained to deal with a situation to get it under control. That the level of violence that's involved just in that part of it, in and of itself, is subject to debate. And
which raises an initial question: is what was there to control exactly? I mean, yes, they came there with a report of a man with a gun or whatever, but with a little investigation, I mean, almost no. All they had to do was talk to the owner, and the owner would tell them, "No, this guy, I gave him permission, and everything's fine, and he's totally nonviolent." But obviously they didn't bother with that, but...
They wrestle him to the ground, and one of the officers realizes that he feels what appears to be a gun in his pocket. At least that's how it looks now. I mean, they're not releasing any more details other than what you can see on the video, but it appears that one of the two officers says he's got a gun. The other one pulls his gun out, and then... It's hard to tell if the subject is complying or not or whatever's going on, but all of a sudden there's a bunch of gunshots at point blank range, you know?
Right. It looked very much to me like they had at least one of his arms completely controlled and pinned, and the other one was pinned under his body. That's what it looked like to me. So the idea that he was reaching for a gun was,
well,
frankly, is kind of ludicrous.
I don't think that's even going to be claimed because the video would refute that directly. I think the bigger issue is under the stress of the situation, which, you know, did the police create the stress? Did the subject create the stress? Did the fact that any random person out there, could and may very well just have a gun, does that change the whole dynamics as to how police interact with people? Which leads to the other case that happened in Minnesota,
right,
where the individual, I mean, this is horrendous what happened, of course. The person gets pulled over for having a broken tail lamp. He indicates to the officer that he does,
and
in fact,
the, he's the passenger, by the way. He's the passenger.
What's that?
He's the passenger.
Yeah.
He's not even
the
driver.
The passenger, right.
He was the
right,
passenger.
Right. So he ends up indicating, as he should, to the officer, I do have a weapon, I do have a permit. And the officer, this isn't on video, but at least how it's been recounted, is that he goes to reach for his ID. The officer shoots him a bunch of times.
Right.
And
four.
Then as things unfold, they're pretty slow about dealing with the situation. And, you know, the really shocking thing about the video is the guy dies on the video.
The video is 9 minutes long, and the entire time, after this guy is shot, the entire time the cop is standing there outside, still pointing his gun. I don't know, presumably waiting for backup or something, not trying to render aid, not trying to do anything. So it was rather remarkable. Just to jump back to that first video, I heard, needless to say, this is obviously the talk of the town, of the country, regarding how this went down, and it struck, like you and I have pretty similar perspectives, but not everybody shares our perspective, and this is the interesting part that I found when I heard this caller on one talk show, and I forgot where I heard it. It's like, I think On Point or something, and this guy calls in with a very, very, very pro law enforcement attitude. And he was lamenting that this guy wasn't complying. This is the gentleman in Baton Rouge. And he's like, all he had to do was comply. And, this thing escalated, and you can't really tell if he was reaching for a gun or not. I mean, he was doing everything. He reminded me of our Court of Appeals. He was doing everything he could to find a way to blame the guy that got shot for his own demise.
I've heard that being said too. Yeah, I've heard that being said about this particular incident.
And this schism.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. People are saying, "Well, okay, it might look horrific, and it is horrific, except that, blah blah blah." You've got video documentation of exactly what happened, and regardless of how quickly the guy is putting his arms behind his back, or how quickly he's falling to the ground as he gets tackled, you shouldn't end up getting shot,
situation. Either one of these,
it just shouldn't happen.
There was zero reason for gunfire. But here's the thing that kind of astounds me is that the police seem to think, and many, just not like to paint all police, and I'm not trying to do that, but they seem to think that the use of their weapons is sort of a foregone conclusion in all these seemingly innocent, not innocent, but seemingly non-huge cases. Of course, they'll probably come back and say, well, that's the most, a traffic stop's the most dangerous time to be a police officer. Maybe not. I don't know.
I think statistically that's true. I mean, most officers that die in the line of fire, it's at a traffic stop. I mean, I think that's what happens. At least that's how they're trained, and that's what I've heard. That if you look at officers that do die in the line of duty, it's usually connected with either a traffic stop or I think second best is a domestic violence call that they're out to.
Maybe
it's the other way around. But both are very high stress situations, let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm just astounded at the schism in this country this is one of the things that kind of bothers me, is that a lot of the people that, like that gentleman, that are looking for every way they can to support whatever the police do, And I'm not necessarily criticizing him for that. But what I am astounded by is the desire to do everything they can to support the police and yet also be like an absolute constitutionalist. And they don't mm-hmm. recognize the irony there, where the Constitution is dedicated to the principle of restraining government power and pulling back right. government power and preventing the police from doing things. And they live in two different worlds in terms of that analysis. Am I on the – do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. But we're going to have to continue this discussion in a few minutes because it is time to take a break and listen to some advertisements.
Oh,
so
I love
please
those.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And we're back with more Legal Defense. Hope you're enjoying the show. I did, John, wanted to tell you that once again, I was out and about at the 4th of July parade, and big deal in Sheboygan here. I mean, they haul every conceivable group of some sort out to participate in this. So you get not only the city older people, people running for office, of course, the mayor, you get the DA waving around, you know, hey, everybody, how you doing? I'm Joe DiCicco. Hi.
Is Joe still the DA up there?
Oh, yeah, he will be until, well, I think end of the year or something like that.
Okay.
But like he's a celebrity. Like, hey, I'm the DA.
No, he was a classmate of mine.
All these people that, oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah. He's a nice guy. He really is. He's a nice guy. He really is.
Little known fact, he's from Boston. And then when he came to he's from Boston.
All he's got to do is open his mouth and you know that because he's got that.
He's from
accent,
Boston and he was paying out of state tuition, and when he was a first year law student, he sued the university to give him in state tuition. I think it's a published case.
Wow. I thought he was from New Hampshire. Well, I'll ask him. I thought he said New Hampshire is where he's from.
Oh,
it's somewhere up in New England.
Something like that, yeah. So,
yeah, okay.
Anyways, I'm sorry.
But also they had, you know, the Volkswagen Owners Club. They had, certainly every police and fire department, everything like that. They had the high school bands. They had the high school cheerleaders. They had – then it got kind of weird because they had, like, the people from U.S. Cellular, and then the people from the car dealerships, and then the, you know, it's like, wow, we're just turning this into a really long parade. And it was fascinating. It was utterly fascinating.
Well, I'm glad you had fun.
But as I was out and about, you know, shaking hands with people and all this other stuff, got a lot of feedback about our show. I mean, probably 100 people were saying, God, I love your radio show. John Birdsall, I said, hi. Oh, yeah, it was really quite interesting. I mean, I get phone calls and emails and things like that, but to be out amongst the good people of Sheboygan and have
You should have had your own float. The Kirk O'Bear Legal Defense float, and you're up on top doing your parade wave.
It actually would have fit right in with everything that was going on. I mean, it's not like it's I think Cousin Subs had something going. I don't know. I mean, like, pretty much anything to do with anything in Sheboygan, you're either watching the parade or you're in the parade, or and then you watch the parade.
I would have come up to Sheboygan just for that and followed your float along and heckled you along the way. What do you think? That'd be fun.
That would have been funny. Now, the other thing, and I bet you have the same problem down in Milwaukee, but fireworks here are a complete nightmare. I don't go crazy over fireworks. I'm fine with them. I mean, if it's easy for me to watch them, I will. But I'm not going to spend 2 hours working my way downtown hoping to find a parking space convenient place to watch. Then the ridiculous trek back home to the other side of town, which takes another 2 hours. I mean –
yeah, it's a bit of a hassle. Yeah. I usually live in some place where I can walk.
I go up on the roof of my house and watch. That's what I do. Just easier.
That's what real Americans do. Okay. Yeah.
I did have to bow out of a tradition that I've participated in years past, and I regret it. But we have this cardboard regatta race, and the goal is to build a boat that's at least temporarily seaworthy out of cardboard. And you got to be able to fit people in it. And then you actually, you know, quote unquote, race the boat. The idea really is to just so it doesn't fall apart before you're done with the event.
And where are you racing it exactly?
This is on the Sheboygan River. And
it's on the river.
Okay. On the river. And it's a hoot. It's really a blast. But I have in the past emceed this event with my good friend Hans Graf. And we've done it together a couple times where – and it's good to have more than one person. As you know, like on this radio show, it's just the dialogue makes things better. But what I didn't know is that it takes about 4 hours for this whole thing to work out.
Wow.
I just had too many other professional responsibilities that day. So, but anyway, I promised I'll do it again next year, and hopefully that will maybe we'll invite you on up and
yeah, you know, I'd love to. That'd be a blast.
Participate. So
yeah, blast. Yeah.
So anyway, getting back to police
back
shooting
to killing people. Yes,
you know, you said something that I did think was worth expanding on a little bit, and that is that you know the police are armed. For really one good reason, and that is to assist them in doing their jobs, but more so because they have them, not so much because they use them. And the reason I say it's similar to something you just said is that, you know, in both of these situations, police were trying to control a situation, and they were using guns to control the situation by firing them. And that's, you know, it's bad enough that a gun gets pulled, like, automatically in a situation like this, but you know, to use it the same way that you would your voice or some other non-lethal form of control to try and get the situation stabilized, whatever. You know, and when the police themselves are escalating the situation beyond control, it's just interesting that we're creating such a dangerous scenario because the guns are being used incorrectly. And I know that they get a lot of training on the right way and the wrong way and all that other stuff. But, you know, if any human being goes into a scenario where they feel, and I'm not saying they were threatened, but if they feel threatened and you've got a gun and it's there and you know you can use it, I mean, it's just so, it's so hard to predict that someone could respond to that situation uniformly. Now, that being said, I think that when somebody has that level of responsibility and you're trusted with a lethal weapon that can kill people, I think by all means they need to be prosecuted for mishandling that that responsibility. I mean, it's I don't know if it amounts to a, you know, like an intentional murder, certainly not, but you know, in terms of responsibility and making sure that as a society we have a response to this kind of incident, I think it's absolutely called for.
One of the problems, I think, in terms of the rampant use of police officers' weapons is it's sort of like a lot of other police transgressions, bad searches, bad interrogations, etc., is that they know pretty much that, with few exceptions, they're going to get a pass on whatever happens. They might be on administrative leave for a while, but they're not going to really suffer any consequences. The courts are not going to say, you know, this was a completely unjustified. DAs aren't going to say this was completely unjustified. They're always going to find, just like that gentleman caller that I referenced earlier, they're going to find a reason to justify it. It's just like what happened mm-hmm. with Dontre Hamilton down in Red Arrow Park in downtown Milwaukee, you know, and John Chisholm, who I like and respect, I really do. But, you know, I mean, they're just going to find a way to support this killing no matter what, really, you know. And I was kind of surprised at that particular one.
You know, when all that happened, I thought that the era of body cams and so forth would start changing decisions that were made in terms of prosecuting or not. Mostly because the way it used to be
It's still kind of early.
I know it is kind of early, but I'm just saying that it's not stopping the shooting from happening. And I thought that
might be one positive
consequence, but it's not. Okay. It's absolutely not.
Let me throw some numbers out. This last year, 2015, nationwide, 990 people were fatally shot by police. Okay? So as of a week ago, There have been 26 more fatal shootings this year than at the same time last year. So this year so far, these are numbers compiled by the Washington Post, by the way. 509 shootings so far. But here's the interesting breakdown, okay? Wisconsin has 11 of those. New York has 10. New York has less than Wisconsin. North Carolina has 17 of those. Mm-hmm. Georgia has 16. Florida has 33 of them. California has 64 of them. Arizona has 23 of them. Okay? That's the breakdown there. But the body camera, just to speak to your issue, of that number, 445 did not have body camera. So almost all.
Wow. That is a surprising statistic. Wow. Interesting.
Well, as I say, it's kind of early, and nationwide, there's a lot of pushback by the police. They don't want the body cameras. And I don't understand why. If I was a police officer, I would totally want a body camera.
It's not universal that all police don't want body cameras. There are a lot of police that do agree that it's a good idea because, you know, if it's a situation where you get trained on how to deal with these situations, and if you follow your training and if you do the right thing and you do end up having to kill somebody under the circumstances, you're going to want that body camera.
Yeah.
Honestly, you're going to want
another,
it there.
Here's another interesting statistic is the question of that 509 so far this year, of the ones fleeing from the scene, 336 of those shootings, the person was not fleeing.
Wow.
So some interesting numbers just to sort of kick around a little bit in the context of this discussion. I think we're probably up on
break time.
Time
to take a break.
Yep.
John, we're going to come right back after these messages. Please stay tuned, folks.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back, folks. We're back with more Legal Defense. John, we were talking just before the break about the Washington Post article that I believe you said it came out last week with this compilation of statistics where police officers have shot people. You know, I wanted to just dovetail that with another observation I had. I believe it was last week. It may have been the week before, but the Los Angeles Times had a similar journalistic effort in compiling records from a case that's going on right now in federal court, I believe, where the Boy Scouts of America are being sued in a class action for covering up, you know, much like Catholic Church style, sexual abuse that had gone on within the Boy Scouts of America. And the interesting thing is that they have released many records publicly that are part of this litigation. So the LA Times put together this database called the Perversion Files, and you can look up of the many hundreds of subjects that were, and again, these are not defendants. These are people that were involved with the Boy Scouts of America and what the Boy Scouts did in response to allegations of some kind of abuse. And the point of this open records, you know, release while the case is still pending is at least to demonstrate publicly, and the judge ordered this while this is pending, the sort of a methodology by which the Boy Scouts of America went about, and they did their investigations, but their remedy when they would discover something happened would be to put somebody into a quote-unquote confidential file that they maintained. And the confidential file was held by, you know, headquarters, Boy Scouts of America. And when somebody applied to be an adult leader with an organization, they would do one of these checks, you know. And this goes back to the 50s where they'd call up somebody in, you know, headquarters and say, hey, can you look through your thumb through the Rolodex there and see if this guy is on the list? And, you know, if the person was on the list, they'd say, oh, no, don't approve this person to be a Boy Scout leader. And anyway, the point is they didn't refer them to law enforcement. They didn't call the police, or, you know, at least in most cases they said, you know, okay, we don't want you to be in the Boy Scouts, but have a good day, you know. And they also, this is very interesting if you look it up, part of their decision-making process in terms of whether to ban the person from scouting in the future was a review of their involvement in scouting and like how many merit badges they had. You know, I mean, adults don't get merit badges, but you know what I mean, like awards that they had received. The implication being that if someone had accumulated a great deal of recognition in the Boy Scouts, well, that would weigh against whether they're banned from scouting in the future if they were having sex with little boys. You know what I mean?
Right.
So wait, and that's not really my point of this discussion, because that all in and of itself is interesting that this is public information, but even more interesting is this. And I spent a couple hours looking at this just because I found it so fascinating. You go back and you start looking at some of these old files, and you can glean from each particular case what the scenario was. In a lot of cases, it would be a scout leader that was, you know, just taking liberties, as it were, with and there were suspicions and that kind of thing. And yeah, that probably shouldn't be reported, but still, you know, enough where there are parents that are concerned and that sort of thing, where nothing concrete ever came about. But there are other cases at the other extreme where, you know, this man has had a long history of sexual advances towards young children going back 20 years. I think it's finally time to do something about it and get him off the list of acceptable, you know, candidates. But here's the really surprising thing. You recall, it wasn't that long ago that the BSA had an official policy that right. nobody in their organization
can't
could
be gay,
right. homosexual. Right.
Right.
So what I don't think the LA Times vetted carefully enough was that when they're calling this investigation the perversion files, it contains a lot of cases, and I don't just mean a couple, but a lot, where the reason the person was quote-unquote banned from scouting was because they were determined to be likely homosexual. I think that's a big flub on their part. And, I mean, there are people's names. Some of them are still alive, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, so – and you should read some of this stuff. It's horrendous. That I mean, it's bad enough that – okay, the Boy Scouts and their policies. Okay, I understand that, and that's what the lawsuit's all about. But the LA Times bears some responsibility here for
kind of outing people, so to speak.
Yeah. I'll give you one example. An individual was in the military and had been in Boy Scouts before he went in the military. He gets discharged from the military, not court-martialed, not prosecuted, but discharged. Based on a, whatever it was back then, a 51.9, you know, homosexuality or rumors of homosexuality. You know, and by the way, back then, you didn't have to prove homosexuality to discharge somebody from the service. You could be discharged for homosexual behavior or homosexual activity. Now, that is not what you necessarily think it is. It's a lot more, you know. Like, let's say, I don't know. I mean, you can imagine all kinds of things where somebody else would say, that seems homosexual to me, you know? You know what I mean? And I swear, there have been cases where it had to do with a person's mannerisms and...
Just like if they were effeminate or something?
A lisp, you know? I mean, I when I was in the military, there were cases
funny,
like
maybe?
That I saw. Where somebody just had an effeminate sort of way of speaking or something like that. They try and discharge the person because they thought he was deliberately trying to sound homosexual or something. It's just awful what the military and what the Boy Scouts did to people. But anyway, so this one case I was referring to, he gets discharged from the military, comes back home, wants to rejoin the Boy Scouts. And the correspondence between the local Boy Scout unit and the headquarters, BSA, is ridiculous. They say, we've determined something about this leader that we're sure you wouldn't want him to be in the Boy Scouts of America. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And they say, well, we figured out that he was discharged from home. Okay, so then he gets, they put him in the confidential file. Other cases where just based on rumor and suspicion and innuendo, similar circumstances where people are booted out of Boy Scouts because parents thought that he acted a little, you know, swishy or whatever they were trying to say. And you know, here's the LA Times putting them in the perversion file. So I think they should take a look at that.
You know, I was actually looking through some of these, and the actual documents, the actual confidential files here, and not only do they list out the name, and then they put down, I'm just looking at, I just grabbed one, just, you know, randomly, and they circled, let's see, criminal action, court action, reported to state agency, but then down below it says, list of attached documentation found innocent by court. So
yeah, I know. And then they're still put in the confidential file, you know?
Right.
But, you know, it's a private organization. Legally, they can do that, you know, just like the military can discharge people if they're found innocent at trial. I mean, that happens all the time, unfortunately. But, yeah, interesting. This this falls in the category of, like, mega journalism, you know? Like which I enjoy, by the way, reading these sweeping investigative journalistic efforts, which the New York Times is very good at, but
most of
the LA Times has a good reputation as well. But
yeah, we need more of those. We had a couple in Milwaukee. Remember when we had that the DEA ridiculous Fast and Furious nonsense they had going on in the inner city where they were you know, and that was an excellent deep dive by
the Journal Sentinel that did the piece on how Waupaca County is. Or Washera County is so out of whack with the rest of the state by their DA's office dismissing drunk driving cases left and right.
Oh,
right. Journal Sentinel.
Right.
Yeah.
The one where...
Which was inaccurate, by the way, because it was... Well, the suggestion was that prosecutors should never exercise discretion in that scenario. And I think a lot of people, when they... in general, have a concept of what drunk driving cases are all about. They think about the guy who's swerving all over the road.
Right, about to crash into
they fail the field sobriety
test. They're about to crash into a bus full of children or something, you know.
Or a bus full of nuns. And he blows a .39 and he throws up all over the place. But, you know, because of the fact that the law is so much more encompassing than that sort of paradigm of drunkenness.
Oh, yeah. I have one now. My client's 21st birthday. He's pushing the scooter down the street, and his friends are trying to tackle him because they thought it was fun.
Oh, he told me this.
Arrested for drunk
case,
driving.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Drunk driving.
Oh, boy. pushing his scooter.
Pushing his scooter.
Oh, boy. Well, you should win that one, I think.
I'm kind of hoping on it, but we'll see. It's early.
All right. Time for a break, but we'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. We were wrapping up things on this discussion about mega journalism, but, you know, there was this other case that came out this week from the Court of Appeals that warrants really a discussion about the general topic of what's known as the inevitable discovery doctrine. And without getting into the details of the case, it just basically involves a deliberate Miranda violation. And those of you who are listening to the show regularly probably know that Miranda, or even if you never listen to the show, or if you've ever watched TV, or if you've ever been to a movie or anything that involves
the right
reading
to
somebody
silent,
there. That thing.
Turning,
yeah,
blah,
that one.
Blah, 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 blah. Right.
So, you know, there's obvious ways that someone's Miranda rights can be violated, like not reading them when you're supposed to, or saying, like the case I just had about a year ago where the police said, "You don't have the right to remain silent because I'm not going to read this card to you." And then later saying that, you know, he should have somehow overpowered the police by insisting that he was in custody. And since he didn't say so, he was in a locked room with the police.
The courts have now put the onus on the suspect. Yeah.
Right. 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 And they play around with whether or not he really is a suspect or a witness, or whether he really is free to leave or not. And there's all that other nonsense that deals with things like this. And usually when there's a finding of a Miranda violation, it's a technical violation because, you know, the police are trained to get around the requirement to read it to begin with. And if they do read it, they're given some leeway in terms of how they read it. But there's that line that when they cross it, everybody knows they've crossed it, okay? You know, when there's a deliberate, intentional violation of someone's constitutional rights. And that's what this case dealt with, where there was a pretty significant violation of rights. Now, that results in the exclusion of evidence under the exclusionary rule. When there's a violation of a constitutional right, the consequence is that that evidence that was unlawfully obtained against the person's rights can't be used against that person. Natural. You know, that's, we always think about it that way. Although there are those that say, us included, the exclusionary rule has, it's on its deathbed. It's in a coma right now.
Yeah,
it's,
pretty
it's,
much.
It's barely on life support. Its heartbeat is hardly palpable. But
it's got a team of surgeons around it.
There is a team of surgeons hoping to do some fairly invasive surgery. But the point is that there are all these other subcategories which we find, you know, we can put them in the group of you did wrong, but it's okay type remedies for, that's the police, like, to that's still,
like,
do these things.
That's like every case lately, right? Fourth yeah. Amendment, you know, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, even, yep. You know, I mean, just whatever, you know, like, you whatever right. The violation is, you know what, you didn't right. really mean to do it, so it's okay.
It's written in the Constitution, but it was written in cryptic ink, and we can tell that there's yeah. a lot
well,
more to
it's just
it.
Like, it's just like that recent Supreme Court case with the search, you know, and where it was a they discovered a warrant later and that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm sorry,
right.
but this is the same.
Well, anyway, this is we've already seen many cases under, there's something called the Leon good faith exception, when the police make a mistake, but it was an honest one, which involves, of course, guesswork. And what police is going to go into court and say, yeah, I did that on purpose because I hate this defendant and he's a piece of crap and I want to make sure he goes to prison forever. No, they say, oh, sorry. Yeah, I really thought it was a valid warrant. Oh, my bad. And then they get a pass and they say, oh, okay, as long as it was good faith.
Well, as long and as there's you also, try. Yeah, sure.
Right. And then there's, you know, the various other, you know, counter remedies to these violations. But, you know, one that's always been out there that hasn't really been utilized much by the courts in Wisconsin, or to a very limited extent, let me put it that way, is this inevitable discovery doctrine. And the idea, just like it sounds, is that if the police were prone to or likely going to find this evidence anyway in the normal course of whatever they were doing, no harm, no foul. Okay? Or I should say harm, no foul. But
in this case, true.
So yeah. It involves, and it's always traditionally, at least in Wisconsin, been applied in a very limited basis because it requires a crystal ball that you don't have. It requires speculation into where the investigation would have gone. And even though it is an expose in ineptitude, you then assume that everything else about the investigation would have gone perfectly and resulted in the recovery of said evidence. It's really, pardon the pun, a cop-out when it comes down to an analysis of this situation. I mean, it's just yet another way where even when – well, let me say this. The courts bend over backwards to not find violations of people's rights where they probably should. Then well, the next level is that when they do find the violations, they find reasons to not grant a significant remedy for the defendant.
Even more aggravating in this case is that – the reformulation, you know how they reformulated the standard for inevitable discovery?
Yep.
That wasn't even raised by the parties. That was not an issue raised or discussed by the parties. They just took it on their own to reformulate it. And they even changed the standard from clear and convincing to preponderance. So, I mean, this is another thing that bothers me, is that a lot of conservatives are going to say, well, we don't want people – we want judges. We don't want people legislating from the bench.
That's a classic example of legislating from the bench.
This is legislating from the bench absolutely off the charts. And that's what goes on every day in every court of appeals. I mean, it's that whole thing about, oh, we just call balls and strikes. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you decide which one, which how big the ball is, and which way it's going to go. And you know, I mean, you
make especially the rules. When it's you're right, especially when it's not an issue that's even been raised by the parties. And this is a court of appeals case, which is interesting because sometimes the Supreme Court will, you know, take an issue and. You've seen those cases where the Supreme Court will say, okay, this is something that's not been directly raised by the parties, but we take this opportunity to say so-and-so. True. But they hardly ever, you know, change a bright line rule anywhere or make new law by doing that. I mean, that's very unusual. But the Court of Appeals is not really there to make the law of the land. What they're supposed to do is they're more directly connected with the trial court level because it's the first level of direct appeal on those things. So they're not supposed to, you know, legislate from the bench. That's exactly what they did in this case by although you would wonder, this is one of those issues that if you say, you know, could the legislature do something about this? Interestingly enough, the Wisconsin legislature has occasionally, not very recently, but occasionally chimed in with an actual statute that limits what police can do in a particular situation because it's viewed as a legislative responsibility, even though the appellate courts have the ability to fashion how it's applied, you know, on a case by case basis and ultimately to form precedent.
Right. Exactly.
And many states don't have legislatures that are as willing to do that. And there is a question about whether you run into the problem of whether you're running afoul of the Constitution if you go too far the other way. You know, like if we were to pass a statute that said the police do not have to read people their rights in Wisconsin. Well, of course, that's an unconstitutional statute. But, you know, so we do tend to leave it up to the courts to decide those constitutional issues because legislators don't necessarily have the
intellect
resources. Resources. But whatever you just said, I won't disagree.
You'll just let that one pass.
In order to have a full understanding. Well, it goes back to my discussion that I've had over the course of many shows as to what qualifications somebody should have before they are on an appellate court or in the Supreme Court. And I think it's fair to say that you should have a little bit of experience under your belt. You should have done a trial or two, and you shouldn't be appointed to the district court. You should be appointed to the circuit court, then the Court of Appeals, and then the Supreme Court, all within the span of a very short period of time. I think
wrong. Yeah, that seems like that seems like a really great plan. You should be governor. You should be governor.
Yuck.
But, you know, I think you're right. I think you need some baseline experience at the trial court level, really in the trenches, so that you understand how things actually work, and not just fancifully decide this is the result I want to get to, and this is what my intellectual brain power is going to fashion to get there, despite whatever's happening on the ground in real life.
Yeah, you're really not supposed to pick the result first, and then evidence-based figure out how you got there.
It's that evidence-based approach, just like, you know, I mean, that should be the same as for, you know, policymakers as it is for judges, really.
I agree. Hey, on that note, we've got to go.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So thanks for tuning in this weekend. Tune in next week right here on 1330 WHBL and 101.5 FM. Have a great weekend, everybody.